What's happening? Welcome to Wong Notes Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Wong. It's feeling good. April 2024. Here we are. We're already here in April of 2024. Feels good. Feels good. I'm down in Austin, Texas right now doing a little run of shows with Wolfpack. Hope to see some of you there. I would spend this time right now trying to promote it, but guess what? The shows are all sold out. So if you got a ticket, come say hi. If not, well, get a ticket to some other show because we actually just announced in September, we're playing the Bay Area and in LA. We're recording a live, well, not a live album. We are recording our next album live on stage at these shows. Similar thing we just did with the Fearless Flyers at Blue Note in New York City. If you haven't listened to that, go check it out. Very fun. Very fun way to make a record. A little different level of pressure. You know, you got to be on and you get one take, you know? Or in this case, we're going to get like eight takes because we're doing eight shows. Whatever. It's going to be great. We're also playing in Europe this summer. Come say hi. Hey, it's a guitar podcast here. So I got to come at you with a challenge. Okay, here's my challenge for those of you guitar players. Can you play any note on any string on the neck? If I said, play a C on the third string, boom, can you do it? Play a B flat on the third string, can you do it? I want to challenge you right now. Learn to play every note everywhere on the neck. Go around and play every C you can, every F, every D flat, boom. Go through all the notes. Make sure you got them. Because note location is important. It gives you anchors for your scales and your chords. Now, if this sort of thing interests you, if this sort of thing confuses you a little bit, I've got a course, the Corey Wong Guitar Course. It goes through all this stuff, okay? You need this course. No, it's not just a rhythm guitar course. It's a fundamentals course. It's beginner to advanced. There's all sorts of things. There's over 6 hours of lessons on there. It's dope. And today on the podcast, we've got guitar slinger, singer-songwriter Marcus King. Marcus has a brand new album out. It's great. Produced by Rick Rubin. Great songs, great guitar playing, great tones. It's dope. So check it out. Marcus is really great. This album is awesome. My favorite one of his yet. And we get into a good interview. So without further ado, here we go. Marcus King. Hey, you guys know about DistroKid yet? If you are an artist, musician, somebody who's trying to get your music on Spotify, Apple Music, all of those things, DistroKid is a digital distributor that can get your music on all of those platforms. It's the easiest, fastest way to do so, with accounts even just starting at $19.99 a year per artist. So for me, I have several albums out. I just pay one amount for the year. For all the Corey Wong albums, I just pay one amount, and DistroKid takes 0% royalty. 100% of the royalties come straight to me. Or you use their Teams feature where you can dedicate a certain percentage to one member of your band, a certain percentage to the other, or one of your collaborators. I do this sort of thing. It works amazing. DistroKid is who I use for my albums, and it has worked great for me. The stuff gets up there fast. They have a smart ISRC thing. I don't have to worry about coming up with my own codes, registering a lot of the stuff. They just have that. And they also have these really cool design tools. If you are not very design savvy, they'll help you come up with assets for social media and other things to help promote your album. And if you want to use them, you can use my VIP code. Just go distrokid.com/VIP/Corey Wong and you get 30% off. How about that? Check them out, DistroKid. All right, let's hit this episode. Well, Marcus, thanks so much for joining us, man. It's good to see you.
Hey, absolutely. Good to be here.
Can you talk to me about your guitar playing on this record compared to your past records? How did you approach as far as the way you played your rhythm tracks, the way that you played your leads? Because the guitar playing and some of the focal point of this record does feel a little different than some of your last work.
Yeah, well, I feel like in my recent efforts, it was the guitar that was a safety blanket for me and a shield and something I could hide behind. And in this record, working with Chris and with Corey and Rick, I mean, everyone involved, really, I wanted to listen more than I wanted to play, which is usually the case, but especially so on this project. So I feel like that's reflective in the approach, but also wanted to use the guitar again. It's like a garnish instead of a main structural point. So we wanted everything to stand without the use of guitar. And I mean, there's for the first time in my life, there's tracks on this record that don't even have guitar on them.
Yeah.
Or rhythm, anyway.
How do you feel about where you're able to most comfortably and effortlessly express who you are? Do you feel like it's more in the studio or do you feel like it's live?
Ooh, man, that's a lovely, lovely question. Because, you know, I know you can relate. It's a little bit of both. And I think you're always trying to thread that line of like, there's something powerful about the live show to me. Because like for me, I've got social anxiety. So if I go and it sounds just like the record, I mean, it's almost like I could have stayed at home and listened to the record. You know, I want to hear, like, and I always use this example, but like that Chi Lights sample that Beyonce used on Crazy in Love, like when they play that live, they have a live drummer and she could just as easy, you know, it's Beyonce, for God's sake, she could go out and play to a sample, but she does a live band. So it's something really different when you get in that live room with people and you really interact and you can really feel them. And that's what I grew up doing, was, you know, from growing up playing gospel and being around my family, just the community that music provided. So, you know, that's kind of where my heart tends to go, is the live show. And in the studio, though, I feel obviously I can be a little more refined and a little more vulnerable and honest, because you don't have that immediate reaction of people, you know.
What is your touring schedule like these days? How many shows a year are you doing typically?
A lot less than we used to. I know that. It felt like we used to do a lot of, and I wouldn't say arbitrary touring at all. You know, I feel like it's been referred to as that within my team, and I always have to correct them. Like, we love what we do, and we played a lot of shows that maybe in hindsight could have seemed arbitrary, but they were all impactful and important. And playing these little towns and stuff, people really appreciate you bringing the art to them. But we used to do like 200 some odd dates a year, and it was really taxing. And after the pandemic, I think like a lot of us realized, you know, it's not that bad being at home. So
yeah,
now we try to do it a little bit more cohesively and around releases and what have you, make the touring a little more conceptual rather than just, we just live on the road.
Well, it's interesting. I've been talking to a handful of different artists recently. I feel like, you know, everybody was itching to get back out on the road for a year or two or there. But now it seems like a lot of people, for whatever reason, there seems to be a common thread of, it's just a lot harder. It's just a lot more taxing to tour right now. And also expenses are so high, like bus quotes are doubling. All these rentals are just going insane. And it's just like a lot of, I mean, people just in general in public spaces like forget how to act sometimes, and it can be you know, a little overwhelming for some folks. But it is interesting to see, like, a lot of people are kind of like, yeah, let's be a little more intentional about our touring right now,
right? And I think you really said it, man. Like, it is difficult. Like, you know, for me, I make a lot of efforts to bring the comforts of home in a travel-sized way, like, but then you start to feel almost a little prima donna-esque, like when you have like a collapsible cold plunge and you got your Peloton on the road. And, you know, I'm really grateful, like the bus company we work with and the production company, all that is folks that we've worked with from like day one. They invested in us as like, they just believed in us early on. And, you know, we kind of, during the pandemic and stuff, we made efforts to go and work at like our production companies and like bring the crews in and like try to get them to work for like socially distanced, like live streams and whatnot. So we've maintained a lot of really great relationships in this company, in this business rather. And, you know, they take care of us now for sure. But especially with an 8-piece band, man, it's hard to find that comfort of home.
I feel you. So you're bringing your Peloton out? My tour manager told me I couldn't.
Right.
I thought, I was like, yo, dude, I'm bringing my bike. He's like, how often are you actually going to use that? I was like, every day. He's like, just go to the gym.
Man, yeah.
You got yours out on the road with you?
Yeah, that's the plan. This will be the first run with it on the road. And I'm so thrilled. Like, we've always brought weights out with us, and I would just try to factor in like my cardio days. I usually like to do cardio and lift, and my routine is like gospel to me. I'm really routine oriented and now, and I'm pretty excited to bring it out.
That's great. Who's your trainer? Who's your favorite instructor?
Oh man, Kendall Toole. That's my go-to. Really
nice.
Tough classes, man, but gets the job done.
I've taken a couple of her Blink 182 rides. That's how I know her. Well, tell me a little bit about what gear you're excited about right now, because you have an Orange amp and a Gibson guitar, correct?
Yeah, so live, what I use, an Orange. It's a head that we designed together. It's called the MK.
Yeah.
And we did a limited release of them. And they're pretty much, like, they got 6L6s in them. I wanted to kind of combine the Fender and the Marshall circuitry, kind of have the output authority of, like, a Marshall amplifier or an Orange for that matter, and have, like, the subtlety and just, like, the simplified, you know, schematics of like a Fender amp. So that was kind of the approach there. So that's the head, and it's like 30 watts, which is plenty. And I play that through 8 10-inch speakers, and they custom made these cabinets for me because I don't really like the way 12s break up. So I played super reverbs my whole life, so I like 10s a lot. So
yeah,
it's 8 8 10 Orange cabinet. And it's slanted too, which is the first slanted cabinet they've ever done. And paired with that, I do a 215 like basement cab and a Bandmaster, a dual Showman. And that dual Showman, we actually the output converter on that is from a Brown Face twin, I think. So it's got a little extra oomph to it.
Yeah. How do you describe the Orange sound to people? Because a lot of people are familiar the Fender sound, the Marshall sound, you know, all these different types of things. But I feel like the Orange sound, people are less just boom, boom, boom with a quick answer on this is the sound of Orange amps. Or, you know, people have the Dumble, the Marshall, the Fender. Orange seems a little more elusive to me for whatever reason. How do you describe it?
I think that's a really fair point because, you know, even my answer is not going to be like boom, boom. For me, it was like, you know, Stevie Wonder at the Beat Club, that 74 performance that he did, and all the Orange amplifiers. I just loved the aesthetic. And I was like, I mean, it sounds like a Marshall. And I only later found out it was like, it's kind of become like a metal amp, you know, as of late.
Yeah.
And I made really good friends with the CEO, Cliff Cooper, and, you know, that whole, like, origin story of like how he started out on Carnaby Street and making amplifiers and stuff. I just really fell in love with the CEO. He's such a sweet man. And that's why I stuck around there.
And how about the guitar? Because you developed a guitar with Gibson too, right?
Man, yeah, I did. That was a real thrill. Like never would have anticipated that. And was happy to do that for my grandfather. And I wanted to put his name in it, actually. And they fought back on that, obviously, but it was all modeled after his guitar, Big Red. So 62 345, and it's got a sideways vibrola tailpiece on it. And the story I heard was, you know, Hank Garland had them make that custom with the vibrola sideways like that, because I don't believe that was like that wasn't stock, so it was a custom build from the custom shop at that point. And I guess they sent him the red one and the sunburst one, and he kept the sunburst, and the red one ended up in the ether, and my grandfather bought it at some point when he was stationed in Montana.
Military cat?
Yeah, he was Air Force, and he was staff master sergeant, so he was in charge of like booking the bands and booking the acts, and like he was head of culinary, so he was the like OG vibe coordinator, you know. And
yeah,
he would hire all of his favorite music, which was country and western, and have his band open and back him up. So,
yeah.
And he was a great singer. He lacked the confidence to really do it. He never really had confidence in his singing, but he was such a great singer and guitar player and fiddle player. But yeah, like Charlie Pride came, you know, he got him overseas. And I think he might have gotten Cash over there, but all sorts of just insane stories.
What is it that gave you the confidence that you have? Because I've seen videos of you playing from really young. How did you feel like you had authority over what you do? And when did that kick in?
Man, even the authority I have now is very recently developed, just through, you know, trying to garner some self-awareness and self-confidence and, you know, mindfulness. But for me, it was never really an authoritative thing. It was more like, I just feel more comfortable doing this. It was more of a security thing. So I just felt more comfortable playing music than I did off stage trying to interact with folks. So I just had a real, it was just a lot of just unchecked mental stuff, you know, because we just didn't, you know, my family didn't know what was going on. And music was just the only prescription, I guess, to sound like a, you know, that's a tired old thing to say, but it just felt like the only medicine I was on.
Well, I think certain things, I wouldn't say they feel tired. They're just something that works and works for a lot of people.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I just felt like it was a trope to say it was a prescription, but I don't mean to say. I mean, it really was for me. Like, and when I was 13, I started singing. This girl I was interested in, that was in Mr. Rogers' science class with me, she passed away in a car accident, and that just really fucked me up. And, you know, before that, there was a lot of trauma in my life, but that was the only one. Like, afterward, I didn't feel like I could really just get it all done with just the guitar, you know? It was kind of a subconscious effort to want to release more. So that's when I started writing and singing. And, you know, through that awful tragedy, I was able to find a voice and another way to express myself.
Yeah. Well, I do feel like there's something to being a second generation, third generation musician. There's a lot of people that I've seen where it's like there's something that's just more, you know, not that anything is just completely natural, but there's just something that's more innate when you're surrounded by music, even as a kid, just knowing that family, it's just like, oh yeah, that's what my family does. Like, we play instruments and like do stuff and you express yourself and you pick up the instrument and go. That I watched other people, and myself included, where it's like, oh, it's unique to play music because nobody else in my family does or whatever.
Right.
But I do feel like there's something to a natural comfort level with playing music in general when it's just something that your family has done as well.
Right. I think, I mean, that's absolutely right. I've often, you know, likened it to, like, you know, an Amazonian tribe. Like, when I first got up and played with my father and my grandfather and my uncles, I felt like I was going on like my first hunt, you know. It's like a tribal to like bring the young, you know, it's time. And when I was like 8, yeah, they bring me up on stage and we jam, and that's just how it felt.
So tell me a little bit about this new record, man. I love this new album. This is my favorite stuff that you've done. Tell me about how this process was different than previous records that you've done.
This one was, more of an introspective look at like one's mental health, really, as much as it was making a record. And I don't think I realized that going into it. And I think a lot of growth, mindfulness wise, is usually, you know, that's kind of the case, right? Like, you don't really plan on doing it when it happens. And meeting Rick and working with him was all just so, just felt really divine retrospectively. And, you know, it took us like 2.5 years to finish the record. A year of that was just writing and trying to break old habits, or not necessarily bad habits, but less truthful habits. So, I mean, this one was really just a painstaking amount of hours put into this one. not that I didn't put a lot of care and effort into my previous work, but this one certainly the most.
And for those that are unfamiliar, when he says Rick Rubin, guru producer, cat who's done thousands of records, very well known, incredible producer. I know a lot of people have different processes they do when they're making records with Rick. What was your favorite part about working with him as a producer as opposed to other producers you've worked with?
So when we started the process, it was in Malibu at his place out there, Shangri-La, and that was famously owned by the band previously, and Bob Dylan's old tour bus is there. So there's a lot of really good vibes there already present. And there's also artists coming in and out. So it was really kind of, it was a very eclectic vibe and energy of artists flowing in and out of that space, very open and just inviting and supportive energy without, you know, even saying a word yet. So we worked there for the first set of basic tracks, and I showed up, and it was me and Chris Dave on drums and Corey Henry. And I know both of those dudes, but I'd never met Chris before, and I was pretty, in awe of him. But he really quickly became like the most grounding presence in the room. If you know him, you understand that. He's just so laid back and just made the record feel really cohesive. Because in those first sessions, Rick was doing it remotely because it was kind of post-pandemic and he was still in another part of the world. And he was kind of, through GoPros and power of technology, he was like an omnipresent producer, which was a trip. But my favorite part, to answer your question, was like a year after that, he and I spent time at his studio in Italy and just kind of unpacking the record. And I cut Fuck My Life Up Again there and Cadillac and in their entirety. And just like, that was more intimate because he and I spent a lot of time together every day. Sorry, that was long-winded.
Yeah, no, that's great. Are you somebody who typically likes to record the whole live band in the room together, or did you guys cut stuff separately?
Well, it was kind of a little bit of both. So it really kind of depends on the song, I feel like. And I don't have a particular style that I like to do. Sometimes it really it lends itself to like a live feel. If I'm going to do something that's pretty straight ahead and we know we're not going to worry about a click track on it, we just kind of go in the room and we don't worry about bleed. We just put everything in one room and try to actual live capture. But the stuff with Chris and Corey, we kind of did, it was almost like piecemeal, you know, because one of the original concepts, and we kind of did it, was to like sample ourselves, right? So like live band stuff and then like loop it and sample it and put it in different places. That was Rick's initial concept. But some of that like tracking all together in the room was really special. And no bass player, which was challenging at times, but it really made the record. We had to make everything stand just like, and Corey, he played a lot of left-hand bass initially, but we took all that out and we just produced the record as if there wasn't going to be bass. And then when we put bass back in, it was just an added bonus. You know, we wanted the songs to stand like without that, because if there's a good bass on a track, like you're going to enjoy it, you know, no doubt, but we wanted the songs to really be impactful without just the, you know, whatever.
With the music you play, a lot of people have, you know, you've kind of crossed several genres. You cover some different ground, you know, obviously being in a little bit of an Americana folk thing, rock thing, a blues thing. With this record, tapping into some more R&B and soul feeling stuff. And I think maybe that's some to do with the songwriting, where like it just calls for certain things, but it still feels like you're a blues rock Americana player.
Right.
Is there a certain target on the board that you're shooting for, or are you just kind of following the muse? Where are you at with how you describe yourself genre wise?
I've always kind of felt like popular music tends to have, and when I say popular music, I'm referring to like pop music, and pop music tends to have, you know, a little bit of blues, a little bit of rock and roll, a little gospel, a little bit of everything. It's kind of this amalgamation of all these different genres. And when it's a popular and in vogue thing, it's called pop music. Like the Beatles were a pop band. You know, Little River Band was almost considered a pop band. Peer Prairie League, Marshall Tucker Band, whatever's in vogue, right? And like, for me, I kind of always got tossed around into these different genre types because maybe someone didn't listen to the entirety of the record or, you know, but I never really cared. I just wanted to go where people wanted to listen. And I think you could say the same for like, you know, like I remember like Modesky, Martin Wood, and Scofield were headlining jam crews. Like, you know, I guess they're a jam band, like in a quasi kind of way. But to me, like they're really kind of stretching the boundaries. And there was a moment there where the jam community was really receptive to all kinds of bands to come in. And we didn't really feel at home there in later years, but musically anyway. And then it kind of felt like the Americana scene was kind of taking a similar approach as far as like, these are all the guys we don't know what to do with. It goes into the miscellaneous pile as far as genres are concerned. But like trying to encapsulate somebody and like, you know, it's just really restricting. And I've never told anyone I was a blues player. I've been influenced by many blues players, as, you know, a lot of us have, but I feel as much like a blues player as I do like anything else, you know?
Sure.
It's just as much as an influence to me as, you know, the jazz theory that I studied or, you know, the time I spent learning the pedal steel or, you know, the hours of just practicing everything I could get my hands on, you know, even like traditional Indian music. But I wouldn't consider myself any of those other things. But I do get labeled as blues guitar player a lot. And it's just because it's easy. I get it.
And yeah, I think it's easy for the public to say that.
Yeah, there's worse things to be called, I reckon.
That's absolutely true. So do you feel like you're not accepted in the Americana or jam scene?
Maybe not accepted. And if I said, I mean, I'll rephrase that. I guess not accepted, but just maybe misunderstood.
Sure.
I used to get really anxious in the jam scene because I started to notice that there was like people following us from town to town. And I get really nervous and in my head because we started befriending a lot of tapers and they'd come back and hang out with us and they'd kind of wear us out about like, well, you played this song like three nights in a row. I'm like, but yeah, because it's tight and it's a good part of the show. Yeah. And it really showcases everyone. Are we not allowed to play the same song a couple nights in a row? And that just became like such a, and then I had like this real like duality of trying to build a show, like everything that's tight and I'm putting on a show with horns and I want it to be tight because I love James Brown, but they're not receptive to it because they want us to play, I don't know, an entire different show every night. I'm not sure what the appeal is there to me. And like to look up there and see people with two iPads, one with a chord chart and one with the lyrics, it just feels like I'm at a karaoke concert, right? So I'm like, why don't we get a show tight and like just allow the improvisational aspects of the show to be where you change it up each and every night. But that's also just my opinion. I mean, if you enjoy that other thing, that's cool too. And I mean, you know, I enjoy bands like that as well. Like Billy Strings is one of my good buddies and his show is like, I don't understand how he does it, man. Like his set lists are just ever changing and ever flowing and evolving. And I strive towards that, but I also like appreciate the idea of a really tight, you know, polished show.
Yeah. And I think some of that has to do with expectations, both on the end of yourself and for the fans and the listeners. And sometimes, like if people have deemed you a jam act, the kind of lineage in a lot of cases and a lot of why that community is stoked about stuff is that there's different experiences every night. And I think as a performer, if you're jam adjacent, like myself as well, like I do a lot of stuff that's jam, like right down the middle. And then like with Wolfpack, it's much less jam, but a lot of people expected that out of the band.
Yeah.
And I think we as performers kind of need to figure out like, well, there are certain songs that people want to hear. And if we don't do a ton of shows in a year and we've come all the way to Boston to play a show for the people of Boston, and the majority of the people here are only going to see us once a year.
Yeah.
It's kind of unfair to not give them the best version of this show that we can. So as performers, I think I'm in the similar thing where I'm always like, all right, I need to give these people the best show that I can give them. And of course, there's also need to have some spontaneity and whatever. But like you're saying, we build that into the improvisations and we build that into other things. I think it's up to us as artists to figure out what is the best presentation of our artistry that we can give. And sometimes it doesn't live up to the expectation of certain fandoms, and that's okay. Like,
yeah.
That's fine. And maybe it's also up to us to challenge some of those listeners to say like, yeah, you know what? I want this to be the tightest show that I can be, and it's going to be a better show because of it. And yeah, 80% or 70% of this set is similar to what you might have seen three nights ago, but it also changes a fair amount, and that's okay.
Right. And it's like, where does that change too? Like, people go see some artists, you know, I mean, I don't know, Bob Dylan, for instance, or like a Beck, and like, they're working on new stuff because they're like an ever evolving artist. And they're like, oh, we want to hear Loser or something like that. And it's like, So where does that shift? It's like, it's a wide spectrum. And like, we're all trying to evolve and we want to play songs. Like you said, like, you know, we're only going to be in this town tonight, this year. We're going to play the songs that they want to hear. And I remember, like, while there was kind of like that weird, like, what are we? We were kind of going through another, like, growing stage. And just, I remember playing at Stubbs in Austin and, like, this guy. And I thought it was a very emotive and very moving show musically. But afterwards, this guy messaged me. He's like, I came from Denmark just to see you in Austin. And you played three songs in a row that were 12 minutes in length. And I got so bored and you didn't play Rita Is Gone. And I was so heartbroken and I was very disappointed. And this is obviously when I still, you know, read comments and stuff. I don't do that now. I learned my lesson. But I was like, I felt really guilty. I felt like, man, how selfish am I? Just because I didn't feel good, I didn't want to play the songs that guy obviously didn't fly to Austin just to see me. He must have been there on work or something. But
yeah.
Also, you know, I remembered his name and he, I think, came to a meet and greet or something like months later. And like, so, I mean, whatever.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's interesting. I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one who that those experiences live with. At least one of us isn't reading the comments because I tell myself not to, and then I'll sometimes get in there and I'll be like, oh man,
I can't do it. I know if I'm looking through comments, it's only because I'm feeling down on myself and I'm looking for someone to confirm that, you know. So I just don't do it because I even notice if I am looking at the comments, I'm scrolling past all the good ones to get to the bad ones, because it's just something in me that wants that, and it's just not healthy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like this primal, like, you hear the rattlesnake when you're walking, you know, like you're out hunting for berries and to bring back to the tribe, and you hear the rattlesnake. It's like that's what you remember.
Right.
There's like something innate in us that just wants to find the thing to trigger our fight or flight or something. I don't know.
Maybe it's unique to like young boys, but like your friends are like, wow, this smells really weird. Come smell this. And you go smell it. Cause you would get. Why do we do that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely a thing that artists and I mean, anybody in general now it's part of the modern era is dealing with the good comments and the bad comments. If you're going to believe all the good comments, are you going to believe all the bad comments? If you're going to believe all the bad comments, are you going to believe all the good comments?
Right.
And I've for a while had to stop reading them, but I'm now kind of at a place where I can look at them with arm's length. I learn how to absorb things. And sometimes I actually read negative comments and it's like, okay, you know what? I think this person was actually right. Like their criticism of my show and the way that the flow of the show went, I don't think they're wrong in the way that the energy arc of like when the show could have really ramped up, it kind of dipped in energy. And, you know, looking back, it's like, oh, you know what? They weren't wrong. Hmm. They're kind of a dick about the way that they presented it, yeah. But they're not, the sentiment is not necessarily wrong, you know? So I'll sometimes take things, and obviously do it all with a grain of salt, but I go in phases of being healthy in the way I interpret things. And I feel like I'm in a healthy place right now. Not always.
Oh, yeah. Can relate. I love that you're able to take those and spin them into something positive. I don't know. It's always, to me, like, I have reminders set on my phone, my handy dandy iPhone, every, you know, 3 or 4 hours, I get a reminder that says, do not read the comments. And
really,
the subtext is like, the majority of these people commenting on your Instagram do not have a background in music. You know, it's like, they're not even, a lot of them saying the nasty things aren't qualified to say what they're saying. You know, it's like it used to be, we'd all like be worried as hell about what the critics were going to say. And we just couldn't wait to get our music to our fans. But now it's the opposite way. I feel like I see a lot of critical reviews on bands these days, unless you're going to be on like a Pitchfork or something. You don't see a lot of critical views on album releases, but you do from their fans. If you want, maybe even an honest interpretation, you go see what their fans are saying. It's because the Yelp generation, you know, like my steak was undercooked and everyone needs to know how bad my night was because of that.
Where do you feel most misunderstood by your own fans?
Well, I'm really blessed with a great fan base of really open-minded, just music fans. I guess in the past, I felt a little misunderstood, and it would always kind of be challenging for me. Like, I'd show up and there'd be, you know, you can kind of feel it at meet and greet or you know, just at the beginning of the show. It seems like a lot of guitar fans, because you can kind of feel where the energy really spikes and where it declines during the ballads and whatnot. And I want it to be something that touches on all aspects of the show. And I want them to receive all of it and just be open. And that's something that I'm ever trying to manage, is just being completely present. And that's, I mean, really something I learned from Rick was putting the audience second, which I never considered. I mean, even now, it's like, to say it, I feel like I'm saying something that sounds very selfish, but when you're on an airplane, they tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before you help your neighbor or your child or whatever. I mean, like, I can't put on a great show unless I'm serving myself in some way. And
yeah,
just trying to maintain that balance of, like, I'm going to play a song on piano because I'm not a very gifted pianist. I like to play songs on piano. That's how I write. So it just kind of strips away that, it allows me to be more vulnerable. And it also is like, if you want to go take a piss, that's fine, or get another drink. But if you want to stay, I'm going to play a song and there's not going to be any like crazy guitar solo because the guitar is sitting over there. You know, that's kind of like my way. It was either that or just stand there and sing. And I really don't like doing that. I feel completely nude doing that.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think that's a cool way of doing it. And then you invite those people into that depth of your artistry beyond what they know.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of, you got them there with your guitar, but now you're going to hold them with the songs and your singing.
Yeah. I've said it that way too before. It's like, you know, I've been, you know, again, comments or whatever, like, I haven't read this in any, like, you know, legitimate publication, but, you know, guitar fans weren't pleased with, like, even my last effort, or like my first solo album, El Dorado, like not enough guitar solos or whatever. And I just kind of felt like, why would I stand on like the outskirts or like the fray of like what is considered popular music? Like I said earlier, like the Marshall Tucker Band, when they were in vogue, like it was a, or the Allman Brothers Band for that matter, like, you know, the Allman Brothers selling out Dodgers Stadium and they're playing like a 30-minute mountain jam, you know, that was in vogue because they had Ramblin' Man on the radio. Why would I stand outside in the fray of what is popular music and try to lure people outside of it to come to my subset that's like guitar oriented? Why can't I take my guitar in to the machine and try to produce something that's popular to everyone and everyone can be receptive to it and still have it be guitar oriented? I just never understood the concept of being like, no, no, no. What we do is out here. And if you want to go in there, like you're not welcome over here because, you know, we're hip and we know what's up. Never understood that. It's all about inclusivity, right?
Totally. And I feel like we need people in the machine that are good ambassadors for guitar and guitar music.
Right. And why not? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And for, you know, like, I think in a lot of ways, pop radio and a lot of stuff, even in AAA, there's all the stuff that's down the middle. And then it's like, yeah, and then we have 10% of the stuff that's drawing from other areas, a little bit folky, a little bit bluesy or whatever. There's like some room, there's a few spots reserved for stuff that's not right down the middle. And it will be interesting to see if that, if more of that space can be taken up by things that are not just the straight down the middle pop thing.
Right. It's just, it's so arbitrary. Like if you take a classic gospel record and change the words, then it's a soul record, you know?
Yeah.
It's a completely different Grammy category, but it's the same fucking record. The words are just different.
Absolutely. One of the fun things that I like to do kind of towards the end of an episode to get, cause, you know, it's a guitar podcast. People like gear. Guitar folks like gear.
And I mean, right? I also want to say, like, I love my guitar fans and I love nerding out with the best of them at my meet and greets. I'll take you through my whole rig. I'll open up. But, you know, on a more grandiose level, I wanted to touch on some of that. But yes, let's talk to the guitar guys because that's my bread and butter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Guitar players want to buy stuff. They need permission to buy stuff. You right now are going to give them permission. There's three questions.
Okay.
If you were to tell a guitar player they have to have a piece of gear that's number one, $20 or less. Number two, $100-ish dollars, couple $100 or less. That's the second piece of gear. And then what's the third piece of gear that every guitar player needs? No limit on price.
Man.
So $20-ish, couple $100-ish, and then no limit.
All right. $20-ish. I'd have to say a good guitar pick, I suppose, if I'm thinking in that price point.
Like, yeah.
A good quality guitar pick or good quality strings. Like don't cheap out on strings. It's just like shoes, you know? You got to wear them. You want them to.
What do you use for picks and strings? Just the most benign guitar question of all.
I use Dunlop Jazz 3s. I grew up playing.
Yeah.
My grandfather played mandolin too, and he had mandolin picks everywhere. So I grew up playing with mandolin picks, real little ones. And
yeah.
So the Jazz 3, I really like those, and the grip's nice. So I use those, and I use Elixir 11s, like the NanoWeb. I like the coating.
Okay.
Which I know some people don't like the coating. I like it. And
yeah.
In the $100 range, I'd say like, you got to have a TS9 tube screamer, you know, like for me, like that's the most consistent pedal. It's a good drive pedal without being like too over the top, gets you where you need to go. It can help out just about any amplifier. And then like with no price in mind, I would say,
hold on. Because the guitar players are going to say, wait, TS9 specifically, or are we talking a tube screamer circuit? Are we saying just in general, is this the 808 TS XYZ, which one is your preferred tube screamer?
Man, I think I started on the TS9 and
yeah.
Maybe that's why, but I've tried the 808. Just looks like more options, and I love like three knobs and
yeah.
Just dime them all, or just put like my settings on the tube screamer are like 11 o'clock, noon, and then like 3 o'clock.
Sure.
But I used to use it like when I played bar gigs, my rig was a super reverb, and I just put the tube screamer on the top, and I had to drive all the way down at like 7 o'clock. Tone's always at noon, and then I used the volume as a master volume, and I just cranked the amp, and
yeah,
that got me by playing club dates. And I don't know, man. It just, to me, it's like the most consistent, like off the wall pedal, you know?
Yeah. Great. Love it. No limit on price. What does every guitar player need?
I mean, you know, it's got me thinking like just a good amplifier, you know? I think every great guitar player I know has a super reverb, whether it's their go-to amp or not. Like a
Black Space right Super back, Reverb. Right
yeah.
behind me.
I see, right. Yeah, you got one right there. I mean, you got two of the like must-haves right behind you, and like I would suggest like you can get in for like, I mean, even last night, I have a habit of wherever I am, I get on the Craigslist to see if there's some kind of crazy deal. And there's a 66 Super Reverb around here for, or over near Atlanta for, $1,600. So you can get in for under $1,700 a lot of times with a road case, and I would highly recommend it.
There we go. I like that. I like that. Well, Marcus, thanks so much for joining us, man. It is great to have you. I'm so stoked about this new record. It's so great. It is, to me, just your most incredible work. I'm so stoked to see what happens after this whole thing is off the ground and doing its thing, man.
Thank you so much. I really, I'm really such a big fan. It was so nice to talk to you. I haven't seen you in a very long time. And last time I saw you, I was a bit of a train wreck. And yeah, I really admire your work. And it's great to speak with you.
Oh man, yeah, it's great to see you, man. We got to hang in person, play a little bit again.
Yeah, are you?
I think last time I saw you was Jam Cruise.
Oh boy, yeah. I don't think I was in the best form there. If I was on Jam Cruise, I wasn't in good shape. But yeah, feeling a lot better now.
No worries about that, bro.
Apologies if I was anything less than a southern gentleman, but or if I was out of control in any way. I had a real tendency to do that for a while, but not self-medicating anymore. So let's get together and have lunch.
I love that. Let's do it.
Yeah, man.
There you have it. Marcus King. Yeah, I mean, what he was referring to there, we had a little thing at the Jam Cruise, you know, late night jam session. He didn't have his guitar. I was trying to go to bed. He was like, dude, let me use your guitar. And I was like, I know, I gotta go to bed. I'm trying to go to bed. It's like 1:30 in the morning. I'm not trying to hang all night into the early morning. He's like, come on, just let me use your guitar. I was like, I don't want to hang at this jam for another hour and a half. I gotta go. Sorry, bro. And he's like, come on, man. And I left because I wanted to get some sleep. So, you know, it was no big deal. Marcus is great. Great guitar player. Fun to have him on the podcast. So anyways, hope you're all having a great day. We got another special couple of guests to round out this season coming up in the next few weeks. So tune in, smash that subscribe, follow, whatever. I don't know wherever you're listening. This podcast are everywhere now. So just hit the thing, get the ding. When the next one comes out, we'll see you next time. Peace!